back through and just give a little history on your work with brain injury, and like expand a little bit on your practice.
I have been doing neurofeedback in Boulder for 19 years. I started in with the desire to work with competitive athletes, and that moved me to head injury. I specialize in brain injury. I specialize in ADHD, ADD, anxiety, the autism spectrum realm, and a lot of different performance angles for folks. Sometimes I'm working with athletes, sometimes I'm working with musicians. I feel like every day is a performance, so people that are coming in with the other areas that I specialize in, we're working on performance. I specialize in seizure disorder as well, and have found that in the field of neurofeedback there, you know, there's not a lot of research. It's in its tween years. It's new. And I've stayed in the arenas that I've seen a lot of success. Rehabilitation with brain injury has been one of them. Very gratifying work for my clients and their families, and for me.
Can you explain a little bit about what neurofeedback is?
What happens when you come into my clinic is we do what's called a quantitative EEG. So we put a cap on your head, and we're measuring 19 different lead sites across the scalp. What happens is that's electrical activity that's coming off the scalp. It's a surface reading. And so I record the data in the office, and then I send that data. There's three people on my team, Dr. Stockdale, who's been doing this work for about 30 years. He's in Colorado Springs. He artifacts my data. He hand artifacts the data. So he goes through and takes impurities out, eye rolls, eye blinks, swallows, and those kinds of things. Sends us back that data in map form. And then I have another person on my team, Earl Sugarman. He's a psychiatrist. He is my medical director. He's also my husband. We built this business together. I like having a medical head on my QEEG. Sorry, I mean, you know, medical head in a good way. On the QEEG. So I can have all angles. I certainly, I think my forte is working, aligning, and working really well with clients and their families, but I want other folks, I want three heads on a brain. Every brain that comes in, I want three experts looking at it instead of just one. I just think that's quite limited in a field that we don't know a lot about. So I do a full evaluation, have everybody review the data in a clinical review without the client, and then I present the data to the client. In the data, do you want to keep going? In the data.
Yeah, I mean, I think, okay. I just don't think everybody knows what it is.
So in the data then, we can, you know, QEEG is what I do. It is often misconstrued that that is a diagnostic instrument, and it is not. So people that talk about brain mapping in this realm anyway, this is not a diagnostic instrument, but in combination with a good clinical evaluation, maybe a good neuropsych battery, you can have a sense from a QEEG of what a head injury looks like. And so we can see that data often slowing in the delta region, which is our very slowest wave. Often you'll be making too much slow wave activity. So with your eyes open, it looks as though a part of your brain might be sleeping. Then you can come in to do what's called neurofeedback, which is biofeedback of the brain. So seeing what we see on the map guides us. We put different lead sites on your head depending on what we see on the map, and you can learn to re-regulate that electrical activity. So you can learn to actually speed up that delta wave. Sometimes head injury, it looks different ways, and everybody looks different. Everybody's different. So it looks different ways in different folks. Focal slowing is one angle that looks head injurious, though. Again, it's not diagnostic, so we need all pieces of the puzzle to make that conclusion. And an increased delta coherence, which is a different read on the map, is another angle to train rehabilitation for head injury. And so it's a really efficient, successful tool to re-regulate your electrical activity. It doesn't work for everyone. I stay in those areas of specialty because I have success in those areas of specialty. People will claim that neurofeedback works for all sorts of things, and I'm leery of those claims because it's so new. I've stayed in areas that work.
Thank you.
Okay.
Did you say
QE? Yeah, I can go on and on, so just stop me.
QEG.
Quantitative EEG.
Quantitative.
John?
So what are we talking about?
We're still on the original verb of what you do.
All right, so a lot of what I do regenerative sports medicine. So I don't give cortisone shots. A lot of what I do is I give injections. I'm an osteopathic doctor, so I assess patients, somewhat like a chiropractor would, but musculoskeletally. Most of my patients come to me with sports injuries, knee, back, shoulder, a variety of different concerns. And I look at them, I'm like, hey, how do I figure this out and keep you from having a second surgery or a third surgery? And where I live, there's a lot of people with orthopedic injuries just because of the skiing, kind of adrenaline junkie environment that I live in. Mm-hmm. And I also oversee, as part of that, I oversee a hyperbaric clinic that we put sometimes these patients in to help them recover a little quicker. Every once in a while, we get a brain injury patient. And I don't know how many of you guys have ever done, who knows a little bit about hyperbaric medicine? You guys have ever done it? Anybody ever jumped in a hyperbaric chamber? So we have a medical grade hyperbaric chamber, and we regularly put patients in this chamber who have mild to moderate to severe TBIs. And every once in a while, we get a really severe patient. The guy that came to me 4.5 years ago said, hey, I'm going to be in this chamber for 40 treatments, about 1.5 to 1.7 atmospheres. So that's a pretty deep pressure. And what else can you do for me? And I said, well, we could take our knowledge of sports medicine, regenerative sports medicine. A lot of what I do is I take people's blood and I spin out their plasma. So the blood plasma is the amber colored fluid. If you've ever gone given blood, and they spun out your blood for a lab. That's the plasma solution. I take that and I regularly inject it from to knees or ligaments and necks or backs. To help people heal. Some people know that solution is called PRP, platelet-rich plasma. So I also knew a little bit about Alzheimer's patients, and I said, hey, there's some really great studies out with Alzheimer's and using insulin. Not insulin injected into your arm like a diabetic patient, but infused directly into your brain. Anybody ever done that?
Nope. Yeah.
It's a really good high. So I don't want to smoke weed or anything like that. Insulin in the brain is great.
Yeah. It was a blast, actually.
You
for
were
about two,
like,
3 days, I was felt superhuman.
Yeah. So,
cognition is so amazing. Yeah.
I said, okay, plasma works. Great for joints. Let's see what happens if we mix the plasma with the insulin. Put a few other nutrients in there, glutathione, B12, you guys ever use those?
Yeah.
And put it directly in the brain. And this guy didn't have much to lose. So, because he was living in a dark cave. He was living, it was funny. He said, come over, I can't, the hotel where he was staying next to my office. He's like, I can't get out of my house. Or any guys have a brain injury? Can't get out of your house. So it was one of those things. He's like, mattress. I was like, I walked into his hotel room. This is not something I normally do with my patients. But I walked in, the mattress up against the wall. He's in the back. He's like, come on to the back. And I was like, I can't even see anything. And this strange guy wants me to come to the back bedroom. Anyway, gotta make sure. So literally, we gave him this solution after he'd done some hyperbarics. And literally the next day, he's like, wow, I can sit in front of the computer. I'm not quite as sensitive to sound and light. My brain is working. And what we know about insulin, we know it increases ATP usage in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
We also know it downregulates cortisol. And when they've done these with Alzheimer's patients, over time they've improved in memory and balance, which is a lot of the issues that TBI patients have. We've also seen downregulation of amyloid and tau protein deposition as well. So super exciting about, okay, wow, now we have a treatment, mix it with some plasma, put it up the nose. And we get great results. So we just basically started researching. People started coming out of the woodwork, started getting referrals from, and this patient was from Boulder, other patients who wanted to come. So that's kind of how I fell into the business. And
wow.
It's largely.
Did you say you put it up their nose?
Yeah. It has to be in the upper third of the nose. So the patient's head is back off
okay.
the table. So they're laying back with their head with the nose perpendicular to the floor. And as long as we get it up into the upper third of the nose, patient keeps their head back for 8 to 10 minutes, it'll diffuse through the olfactory nerves. You know, you have a little channels right here. That's how we smell anything.
Yeah.
When you smell something, you have a chemical that mixes with neurotransmitters and neurochemicals in your brain that goes back. Your brain's like, oh, I smell something. Well, there's little routes that go straight into your brain. We know from the literature that it bypasses the blood-brain barrier and goes straight to the brain. So for most brain injuries, and there are some decent studies on rats out there, and we're working on a big study now, but most brain injuries, we can go straight to the brain and get great results for many patients.
Awesome.
All right,
that's cool.
That's
I'm
cool.
I don't know if I can follow up with any stories about going to patients' hotel rooms.
So nothing happens.
That's good. So a little bit about what we do at our clinic, right? Like I said, so we see a ton of traumatic brain injuries, but everything associated with it, right? So whether that's a movement disorder where someone can't stop moving or is really slow or bradykinetic, whether it's some form of dysautonomia or dysfunction in the autonomic nervous system, cognitive, all sorts of things, we tend to see the gamut. What's a little bit different about us is I kind of come at every patient with one thought process of the brain really needs three things to function: oxygen, fuel, and proper activation, right? We can get super, super complex, but if we simplify it down to those three things, that's kind of what we can look at. So when I say fuel, we do a lot of functional medicine. So looking at blood work, saying, is there a pattern of dysglycemia? Is the patient tending towards pre-diabetic, diabetic? Are they hypoglycemic, reactive hypoglycemic, right? Is there thyroid dysfunction? Is there testosterone issue, estrogen? Anything that will compromise the energy system, right? Because at the end of the day, if the brain's trying to heal and it can't get fuel, well then we can do as much rehab and different things as we want. It's just gonna be that much slower. The second thing, if you look at oxygen, right? Is there some sort of an anemia? Especially at altitude, a lot of times we see patients either more of a functional tending towards an anemia or a true anemia, whether that's more of a megaloblastic, so a B vitamin versus, you can have ones due to infectious disease or even just an iron deficiency anemia. We kind of look to rule those things out. And then like I said earlier, dysautonomia with a lot of concussions. Patients cannot regulate their heart rate and blood pressure with changing positions. So those are the patients that every time they stand, they get super dizzy and they get really, really faint. So once again, if you're trying to do, whether it's vestibular rehab or whatever the rehab is, and the patient can't get blood flow to their brain, that's usually a problem. So with every patient, we always gotta say, is there some form of dysautonomia? And with that, we try to identify the cause. So there can be a variety of causes, brain-related, infection-related, metabolic-related, and once we find that, we either try to treat it ourselves or have a referral network of knowing who can treat that the best. The third thing is when we talk about activation, whenever you have a head injury, right, if you think about the brain, so you have the brain stem that sits like this, and then you have the cortex that sits on top, a little oversimplified, but it will work. So within the brain stem, if you think about it, every time there's a head injury, there's always a rotational force. Think of it kind of like a wet towel, and every time someone hits their head, this gets running out like a wet towel. The problem with that is that within the brain stem is where you have all these connections from the eyes, the inner ear, and the muscles and joints, right? It's primarily where you start integrating sensory information, and from there, you send it to higher cortical areas to say, where am I in space? Because you have to know, where's my hand in relationship to my head, in relationship to the rest of the world, so you can interact appropriately. So most of the time with concussion patients, what I see is that there's either deficits in how they're experiencing sensory input, so damage to the actual peripheral inner ear itself, so the actual apparatus, damage to the eyes or muscles and joints, but most commonly, it's more central. So they go everywhere and everyone says, your eyes look fine, your inner ear looks fine, your muscles and your neck look fine. The problem is they're not integrating together. So within the brain, your brain always has to take information, because if you think about it, if I'm looking straight ahead and something moves across my eyes, according to my eyes, the way they register movement, they say, something just slipped off my retina this fast. And if you were to just rely on your eyes, you'd have no clue whether you were moving or the world was moving. And that's why you see a lot of motion-sensitive patients. Because what happens is they have to take that information, they have to bring it back into the brain, they have to say, what is my inner ear saying? And then what is my neck saying? Because it's got to say, inner ear, did we turn our head? Or is that just visual motion? Neck, did I turn my head? So what we see is, when all three of these systems collide within the brain, there tends to be this huge mismatch of sensory error. That's when you see nausea, that's when you see motion sensitivity, all these things. So what we do is we try to look at all those networks and come up with specific exercise protocols or therapies to try to undo that sensory error. Try to get it to where the eyes are saying the same thing as the inner ear and the neck, and then mixed with a lot of, once again, functional medicine and other forms of rehabilitation. So we really try to come at it from a full approach at looking as, does the patient have issues metabolically where they can't even support activation of their brain? And then also, once again, what networks within the brain aren't working well? And then what networks do we know about that work with those other networks that maybe we can use to help increase healthy and viable structures within those networks that are damaged? So it really takes understanding neuroanatomy, neurophysiology, and the connection of everything and how everything integrates and saying, this is broken. What networks or neighborhoods around it can I use to kind of fix it? So that's kind of how we come about it. Yeah.
So we have some smart people sitting here. Really present. John, you kind of already did an example of your hotel room story of a positive experience you had. But do you guys have an example that you could give of using an alternative treatment and having a positive experience with a patient with a brain injury?
Sure.
And you can do another one too.
Yeah. In another hotel room.
I was thinking about that question and have a few ideas. So I'll just go with one. Dave was a client of mine, about a 55-year-old guy. Was driving home at night from a Rockies game. He lives in Longmont, was out in the country, and he got T-boned. So bad car accident. A lot of broken bones and head injury. And lived with that for a while, and he and his wife came in and said, help. She had felt like this person looked like her husband, but wasn't quite acting like her husband used to act, which I think is one of the biggest barriers with head injury emotionally and psychologically, certainly. So we mapped him, did a QEEG with him, and started working at training his brain. So he did coherence training. You know, he probably did 60-some sessions of coherence training. He was a coach. He worked with a lot of athletes at a school or in Boulder. And over time, he started to regain himself, I would say, with, you know, an 80% improvement. I don't know that I think with a pretty severe head injury, with somebody that has a severe reaction, you know, do you get 100% back? How do you get 100% or 90% moving forward? And so he had a really good recovery. I think the most gratifying comment of it was his wife saying, I have my husband back. Mm. I'll work every day for free for that comment.
Should I go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to choose a patient that kind of shows a good balance of the metabolic side and then the also neuro rehab side because we get a mix. We had a patient come in about a month ago out of Leadville. He's a construction worker, and he actually had a history of working in really moldy buildings, and then has been surrounded by every toxic chemical you could ever imagine. And it hadn't quite hit him until one day a wall in the moldy building came down and hit him and knocked him unconscious to where within probably a week, he started having 8 to 10 episodes a day where it would start where he would all of a sudden get ringing in his ears and then severe vertigo, and then he would lose all motor function of his lower extremity. And then he'd lose the ability to understand language, speak language, and then would develop this kind of movement disorder in his hands and his mouth. And it would last about 25 to 30 minutes. Went to all the hospitals, MRIs are clean, MRA, so looking at vascular was clean, looking for seizures, came back clean. And this guy ended up getting rapid onset dementia. So within a few weeks, he's probably got the cognitive skills of like an end-stage dementia patient where you talk to him and he didn't remember who you are the next day. Mm-hmm. I remember going in and, you know, meeting him, and then the next day and he'd be like, nice to meet you. Kind of like the 5-second Tom guy. And so really, really tough case. And when we started working with him, I kind of was like, I don't know what we're going to really be able to do with you. So we started looking into a lot of different things with the metals he was exposed to, the mold exposure and everything, and started treating him from the metabolic side. But when you looked at him from the neuro side, he had a severe, severe dysautonomia. So every time he stood, his heart rate would jump 55 points and his blood pressure would drop 30. Right, so every time he was standing, you could think about it, he's getting no blood to his brain. He's getting extreme tachycardia. Right, so once again, a lot of times the patients that have the really weird presentations send up really bad dysautonomia. So what we found is, so anytime you see a dysautonomia, it could be a variety of things. You can have what's called a feed forward mechanism, which is a prediction. Right, every time we stand, we have to have an accurate prediction of where we are in relationship to the ground, so we can move blood appropriately. But then you also have a feedback system where when you stand in your carotid artery, you should measure blood pressure to say, okay, that was an appropriate program or that was not an appropriate program. And he could not do that. So what we do in our, or what we did with him is we had him on what's called a tilt table, and we'd slowly start bringing him up, and we'd find the point where he'd break down, which is like 5 degrees. We'd drop him down a little bit, and then we would do all of our therapies at that level. Bring him up a little bit, oscillate until slowly bring him all the way up, but doing all therapies at that level, because once again, how appropriate is it to do neuro rehab on someone standing if they can't even stand? So that's what we did with him, and we slowly brought him up. He had a ton of more central vestibular issues. So if you looked at a lot of things from a central vestibular standpoint, it was just an absolute kind of mess, you know. So, you know, you'd spin him in the dark one way, and then he'd feel like he was rotating for, you know, a minute to 2 minutes and just kept going and going. So you can look at those central structures are just taking that information and have no clue what to do with it. So we did a combination of therapies and worked on that tilt table. We did a week intensive, which we do a lot of times where a patient's parked in there all day, and then I'll work on them sun up to sundown 5 different times, kind of work on them 30 minutes, let them sit for an hour, come back, do it again. Right, really, it's helpful with hitting that brain with stimulus up. Just enough, all right, let it relax. Just enough, because it's all about frequency, not intensity. So repetition over and over again. And within a week, he was starting to have memories of the week before and the week before that. I remember who some of his best friends were. And during the week he was at our clinic, he went from having 8 to 10 episodes to only minor tightening up in his throat, which was the initial sign of a spell, but didn't actually have an actual spell. You know, and so that lasted for about 3 weeks afterwards, and then he ended up going back and getting exposed to mold and some other things, which set him back, not quite as much, but it's going to be kind of a roller coaster, I think, with him once again. Who knows how far he'll be able to really recover, but to me that week was like a huge glimpse that, okay, if in a week we can do this, what can we do if we really get rid of those exposures and figure out what's causing this, but continue to find therapies that are helpful so that he can continue on his own at home. At the end of the day, my goal is to not see anyone. If I'm seeing patients over and over again, I'm not doing my job. So ideally, I like to see people and then see if I can give them things to do on their own to become active in their care. Because that's what it's about, becoming active and self-reliant and not having to rely on someone else. So he's a pretty cool case that we had recently.
John, did you have another example?
I have some other comments.
Okay.
And I can... So I just want to talk a little bit about, like, philosophy of TBI care or TBI treatment. A lot of mainstream, somewhat alternative treatments are very focused on what I would call the software aspect. And you brought up some of the metabolic aspect as well. So if you think about your brain like a computer, there's a hardware component and then there's a software component. A lot of therapies are all information-based, retraining, cognitive therapy, going after the software, right? So we're actually trying to reprogram that. You guys do that a lot at Revive. We've talked a good bit about this, but what I understand the brain, when it goes through a brain injury, it's more like a metabolic crisis. That's one of the first and foremost. And I get this from Robert Cantu. I don't know if you guys have ever heard this quote. He says that the brain is in a metabolic crisis and a concussion. Potassium ion from inside the cell going extracellular. Calcium ions going intracellular. Neurotransmitters widely released in a chaotic manner. Takes energy to pump that potassium back, put the neurotransmitters back on so the cell can function. And what I've seen, part of the reason I exist and do brain injury work, is because there's not a lot of people working on that metabolic aspect of treating brain injury. How do we get energy
You know, that's really the question. How do we repair that hardware? And a lot of us are going in there, we're thinking, oh, we do these vestibular exercises, neurofeedback, PT, you know, cognitive therapy, whatever you want to throw at the brain. If you don't have a hardware that's repaired, if you don't have enough juice flowing to that computer, then what's it gonna do? If you don't have a 486 and you're trying to run Windows 10, you know, it's not gonna work very well. You know, if you don't upgrade that processor and work on that hardware first, you know, fix the metabolic crisis, give the brain some energy, plug it into the wall, you're not gonna get so far, or maybe you'll get somewhere, but it's gonna take some time. So what's the best way for us to create energy in the brain? You guys have any ideas? Nutrients? Yeah. Food? Yeah. What else? What is even better than food?
Sleep.
What is even better than that? Think about it. What gives us energy? We're all breathing it right now. Every breath we take, 20% of it goes to power our brain, right? So one of the reasons you don't heal with a brain injury, like you heal with the knees, because you can't set your brain on a shelf. You can't put it in a cast. It has to always be working. Even if you think you're doing nothing, your brain's working. So what happens with brain injury patients? They're trying to heal their brain, and they have to work their brain. So they might need 2 or 3 or 4 times more oxygen than the average person walking on the street. So how do we get that oxygen? Hyperbaric oxygen. It's one of the best ways to do it. Medical grade is one way. You get 10 to 15 times more oxygen pressurized into the brain with medical grade hyperbaric oxygen. With a home hyperbaric oxygen chamber, which the hyperbaric community doesn't really love, you actually get 5 to 6 times when you're using an oxygen concentrator, pressurized deep into the brain. So
6 times of what we're breathing now, or 6 times?
Six times about what your brain requires right now.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's, and the nice thing is you get 6 to 10 times when you're exercising too, but a lot of that's going to your blood and heart.
Mm-hmm.
That's why brain injury patients can't really go out and go do a marathon or something. It's
right.
Just exhaust. They get mentally and physically fatigued.
Did you say what's the difference between the medical grade and the home?
Well, depending on what atmospheric pressure you're pressurized. FDA requirements allow home hyperbaric chambers to 1.3 atmospheres. That's approximately 4.3 PSI. So it doesn't take much extra pressure in either room air or with a concentrated oxygen apparatus to get a lot of oxygen to your brain. That's what we're finding. You don't need a lot of oxygen and a lot of time. If I take somebody and it's interesting. The military doesn't like hyperbaric oxygen. I had a job to go work in Alaska to treat military TBI patients. And they're like, oh, we don't want to do hyperbaric oxygen. And I was like, why not? And they're like, well, we did a study and it said that it didn't work. And I was like, oh, okay. Problem is their sham treatments were at 1.3 atmospheres, which is exactly about a dose that you need to actually heal over time. So anybody has a brain injury, 3 months to a year in a home FDA-approved hyperbaric chamber is going to give them extraordinary benefits. Healing from a brain injury is not something you rest for 8 weeks and you're better. And it's one of those things it may take 3 months, it may take a year depending on the severity, but it is possible given the right correction. How many of you guys have actually, if you have a brain injury or you treat brain injuries, how many of you actually done a metabolic treatment? Metabolic treatments are great. Nutrition, I give an IV nutrition, I give something called NAD, I give Myers nutrients, IVs, I upregulate all those metabolic cofactors. All those things are designed to make it more ATP for the body and the brain, right? So that's why we have to take vitamins and nutrients anyway. But what's the best thing? Best example I can give you this, and this is kind of another story. My girlfriend's dad, or stepdad, he has a souped-up Corvette. It's kind of a fun story. We're driving along, we have some flat roads out near Longmont where they live, 160 miles an hour. And I was like, what makes your car go so fast? And he's like, well, it's got a supercharger. Anybody know anything about cars? Do you know what a supercharger is?
Nope.
Okay, well, I have a little Volkswagen, has turbo in it, it goes pretty fast. But a supercharger? And so my turbo blows gasoline, blows fuel, blows nutrition, blows food into my car. If we think about gasoline more like food for our engine, for our brains. The supercharger blows oxygen into the engine. So that's what makes it go so fast. It blows off my Volkswagen out of the water. So that's the key. We've got to get oxygen. We've got to get a little bit more oxygen because the brain can't just sit on the couch and rest. that's not going to solve the issue. You got to have the oxygen plus the rest plus all the other nutrition first, and then you can do all the software you want. There's people who go just do a bunch of software and it overworks their brain. It's like, and they get worse. So if you don't do the hardware work, and you can do both. I mean, everybody needs both, these autonomic regulations, neurofeedback, I'm all about that. But if you don't do a little bit of the hardware repair with a home hyperbaric chamber, at least some nutrition, you know, maybe intranasal insulin or plasma. What's great about the plasma, it does growth factors too. So we're actually literally getting in there and creating neurogenesis in the brain. If you don't do some of that, you're not going to get the benefits of the software reprogramming that alternative and mainstream people have done.
Awesome. So let's move to the question of barriers that you guys see in your practices, or things that are preventing patients from maybe having the knowledge about your treatments or access, or any barriers that you feel like you face often. You want to start? Mm-hmm.
Sure. I think barriers for the neurofeedback would be insurance. Everybody just nodded. Insurance, money. You know, money is a big, big piece. I submit insurance claims. I try to do everything with insurance as an addition to what I do, because I feel like with a head injury and without a head injury, insurance is like a part-time job. It's hard to figure out. So if we can help in that arena, we try to. But I'd say that's one of the biggest barriers. Neurofeedback with head injury is relatively new. There's not a lot of research. There's not big, huge studies, you know, that promote and endorse it, though it has a good efficacy rate. And the second part of that question, I don't know if you asked it when working.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's okay. When working with individuals, what's the biggest barrier when working with individuals with a brain injury? Mm-hmm. And I think some of the barriers are, you know, with the neurofeedback, you're rearranging, you're reorganizing electrical activity, and that is an organic process. It takes time. It's slow, and it moves, you know, it's just slow. I usually have people train 2 times a week. I have good efficacy at 2 times a week. I don't think you can speed up the pace of the brain. Some people want to come in and do 5 sessions a week and let's get this thing going, and we can try it. But time on and time off is really, really effective. And I think, you know, some of the other barriers, one of the lovely thing that you're talking about is this team. I think as many people that can be on the team that are supporting the person with the brain injury can be just dynamite. And also with the family. So then you have a spouse or you have a parent, or a kid who's working with somebody that is, you know, struggling, and how do you support that system? And when the brain injured person is doing their work, how are other people also working to be in this? It's not often, it's about one person, but there's a whole system that's being affected. So I'm a licensed professional counselor, and I have my boards in neurofeedback and a couple master's degrees, and I think that family system support is what I'm after. That support system. So in a professional team and that family system, how can we support that person? And then how do the other people that are in this person's life as a love, how do they manage this? And so I think that's key.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the most important features. As that person starts to shift and change, the person doing the neurofeedback, different things are going to come in. We don't often know how are you going to re-regulate yourself. So are you going to get this person back, or is this person going to start moving forward into different areas that they weren't into before? So I think that's a big adjustment. But that's just, those would be barriers, I think.
What did you guys know?
I agree on the team piece. So the unfortunate thing is I feel like a lot of the patients I see, they've been to 5, 6, 7 doctors. They've been through the gamut.
It's awful.
They've spent almost all their money and their time, and they're getting to the point where they're already getting skeptical at everything they've been around. And I think a big portion of that is, you know, like Dr. Hughes was saying, understanding what all of us do really well and when there's a time and place for each of those things, and understanding, you know, I have this patient with X, Y, and Z. I think this guy would be ideal for him.
Mm-hmm.
you know, instead of trying to either take on everything ourselves or whatever, is understanding who's good at what and at what time and working together, because I feel like so many patients go to a doctor and if it's not in their ballpark, it's just, I don't know, maybe you should go rest, versus understanding, you know what, you seem like you'd be a really good fit for this person or that person. You know, it's, I think it's all about getting the patient to the right person at the right time. I think that's just healthcare in general. You know, patients just sift through. So that's one thing, is the team aspect, and then being a tertiary provider, or, you know, being the fifth or sixth doctor that they're seeing. The other thing is families and support systems, for sure. So a lot of patients I see end up going through divorces, right? And so a lot of times what I see, especially with the patients that have been everywhere, they're at the point where every doctor said, nah, it's all in your head. And then, you know, the family starts thinking now, well, maybe my wife is just faking it. Maybe she's never going to get over it. And, you know, you can see tangible things within them where they are broken, and it's an invisible injury, you know, that a lot of people can't see. You know, it's not, you know, like they're saying, a broken arm or a broken leg. You can't look within the brain unless they have this, you know, something with their eyes or different things. You know, it's invisible. So I see a lot of families just get torn apart. And then when that happens, you know, what's the person to do? Their brain is injured, and then their family's not even there with them. You know, that makes that healing process that much harder. So I think, you know, the first point would help that, you know, but that support system. And being more, realizing that brain injuries are invisible, and that they're a real thing that people suffer from, and it's not just all in people's heads, I think is a big piece.
Or it is all in people's heads and can't see it.
Touché.
I mean, so, and that's another, I mean, number one, I just mentioned it, we've all kind of talked about that, the teamwork, but like, there's just a lack of knowledge. I mean, I'm not a neurologist, and that's one reason I don't think like a neurologist, because a lot of them come up with fancy diagnoses that are worthless as far as treatment. I mean, not to say that chiropractic neurologists or other people who are out there aren't innovative, but there's not this sort of scientific inquiry about, okay, how do we really look at this? Because a lot of, I mean, like I said, I got these standard operating procedures to work with the military, and they're like, hey, somebody has depression, you give them this drug, or blah, blah, blah. And I was like, that's not the answer. That's not treating the cause. It's treating the symptoms of a condition. So there's a lack of knowledge as to what's really going on. I mean, Cantu says it right. It's a metabolic crisis. You know, hardware is shut down. The lab experiment in brains has all blown up. You know, there's a really serious energy deficit that's invisible. And that's a whole other thing. You go to get an MRI or a CT scan, the imaging doesn't show you anything. Oh, well, you're good. Go back to work in a week. Exactly. Patients look normal. They can't think. They can't sleep. They can't have sex. They can't, you know, their relationships are going down the hill. And they're like, wow, what is going on to me? Mm-hmm. So their mainstream neurologist or their, you know, family practice doctor is like, well, everything looks fine. They're checked off. Go back to work. And they're miserable. And they can't go to work. They lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. They lose a bunch of income. And they lose their relationships. It's like they're dying, and in a sense, their brain is half dead or half asleep, if you want to just call it that. So nobody understands that. What I think the pioneering work, I mean, I know Hillary Sparrow with SeriScan is here. I mean, of people like that are out there looking at nuclear spec scans. We're actually working on a big study where we're going to do fMRI on these types of patients, as well as DTI and DWI. I didn't even know any of this as a doctor. I never got taught any of this. I had to figure this out. I was like, how do we assess what's really happening with a brain injury? The imaging needs to be improved significantly. I mean, QEG needs to be more accepted and understood. I mean, there's neuropsychological testing can be very subjective, but doctors in general don't think like that. You know, they don't think, oh, how do we really assess this? Oh, I'm sorry, you got a little mood disorder. Take an SSRI, go back and call me after you've rested for 2 weeks. That's not going to work.
Yeah, it sounds like a big barrier is knowledge of practitioners and acceptance of some of these alternative modalities, or even knowing they exist.
Yeah, and this should not be alternative. This should be the standard of care. I mean, what we're all doing is much more of a standard of care than anything else that's out there. I mean, you guys are the pioneers in just learning about this. But, I mean, if I had to say one thing, it's getting into that basic understanding of the medical community, or people, anybody in this community treating brain injury, of how to see a brain injury, you know, from an imaging perspective, and then as a patient, learning to trust somebody else beside their own doctor who's telling them they're well. Or they look normal and they should be able to function.
Doctors who, you know, have their way and their, you know, that aren't necessarily maybe thinking about some of these things or accepting them, how to do some convincing and get in front of them even.
I mean, it's all there. It's all on the internet. Everything I have, look at my website, TBA Therapy, it's all the scientific references for everything I'm doing. I mean, I'm sure for you, you've got all your references. None of this is non-scientific. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, there's plenty of science.
But why do we have then the, you know, the, you gave a brief military example, but, oh, we don't like, you know, it seems like some people just decide that they just don't like hyperbaric oxygen.
Doesn't it seem like,
you know,
just
it's
sort of,
expensive.
Even
it's money.
Research,
it's
yeah.
money. I mean,
yeah.
you go to hospital and you get hyperbaric treatments, it's $1,200 to $1,500 per treatment.
Well,
whereas you can do three treatments at your home, you know, for that in a home hyperbaric chamber and get significant benefits.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's so much lack of kind of like, the military doesn't want to, they don't want to use hyperbarics for stroke. They don't want to use it for autism or other things, even though we know it helps some of these. The science is there, but it's...
Wait, you're saying they don't want to do it because of money?
I don't want to say
yeah.
it's all
yeah.
because of money, but there's
well,
a huge money factor there. And from a third-party payer, I wouldn't want to pay for it either
okay.
as, a, as an insurance
okay.
company or
all right.
federal government.
Anything, we're good. Okay, we have 15 minutes. So in our last 15 minutes, and we want to leave a few minutes for questions, but anything else that you guys want to add or that we should know about what you do, your professions, that you haven't already said? Anything that we're missing talking about?
We could all probably talk for a while.
I can go on and on and on.
Yeah.
Make sure, I mean, I think one of the hardest things is making sure you find people that are qualified. People that have experience and are qualified. So many people say they're doing so many things, and I think that's what's hard, you know, is there are a lot of neurofeedback practitioners out there that are getting neurofeedback in a box, putting it in their back room and saying, we do neurofeedback.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like,
just to put it on like
wait
marketing.
A minute, what are you doing? Are you mapping? Are you, you know, are you really going slow and thorough? Is this the right thing for you? Are you too severe for neurofeedback? Do you need to see John to go have, you know, sort of this beginning part to your recovery, and then do we move into neurofeedback? I mean, really, I know you probably at the end, but take your time and look for people that are qualified, licensed.
Okay.
Medically
like,
directed.
If the next question is how do we do that? Like, as a consumer, how do I know that you're qualified?
Yeah.
Because.
I have a list on my website that says if you don't want to go to me, here's how you shop for this service.
Okay.
These are
great.
The things you're
okay.
looking for.
That's yeah, okay. So there are those resources out there because I do, I mean, you know, marketing is fancy these
it's
days.
Fancy
and,
it's a lot of bull. So just watch
out.
You got that?
Watch out.
there's no
just
one
make
period
sure.
of therapy. I think
right.
exactly
just,
like
right.
it's a mix of all of what we're doing. So
right.
anybody
well,
that claims anybody that claims that they have the answer,
they
don't.
Right. And they can cure everything.
And that's unfortunate for any, I think, alternative therapy is like the one person who's fake doing it kind of
yeah.
can ruin it for
right.
others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to add?
No, I'm just
going to
say, I feel like that can kind of be part of whoever the treating physician or whoever of guiding that patient's care. Because like you said, it's such a sea of so many people. Like the concussion TBI industry is a $1 billion industry that everyone's trying to tap into just to make a dollar versus helping people. So I think, yeah, and so I think that's where, you know, if you have a patient and you're trying to get them to the right places, really guiding them, saying, hey, I think this would be a good avenue, or I don't know about this, and helping to educate them because the internet's so great, but it's got so much misguided information.
Sure.
It can take
and
you so many different ways.
He's talking about standard of care. I mean, he's talking about get the person to the right
yeah.
place. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of people are wanting to make money, but standard of care gets dropped out. And standard of care is number one, right?
I mean, it really has to be redefined. I mean, the whole system has to be changed. And, yeah, we're like a little tributary in the big mainstream. But the saddest thing is these patients aren't getting the right care. Most of them, I mean, look at O.J. Simpson or somebody like that. He probably had a brain injury.
Yeah.
You know,
probably.
You know, is he really responsible?
No way. No way he
didn't.
Right. You're right.
No, he was as much the victim as
yeah.
any of his,
yeah, right.
you know,
yeah.
his victims. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we can have some questions.
Does anybody have questions?
I have a question for Dr. Hughes. I've had several, and I'm Mary Fink, I've talked to you on the phone a few times.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Nice to meet you.
But I've had several patients do full hard hyperbaric 40-60 treatments, and they feel really, really good while they're doing it, and then there seems to be quite a bit of a taper, blast injuries, motor vehicle accidents, all kind of across the board, trauma-wise.
It's not enough. It's not enough to do 40 hyperbaric treatments.
Okay.
You've got to do all the other things too. I mean, ketogenic diets, you know, the nutrition. I mean, sometimes if they're severe, they need to do the stem cells and plasma that I do. It's not enough. And the patients that I see that do 40 treatments, the ones that get in their own home hyperbaric chamber, keep treating themselves for a year or two afterwards. It's an endurance race. It's not a sprint. Mm-hmm. And that's where I've seen it. I mean, what you do too. I mean, combining that software. Stimulotherapy is so
interesting.
Important.
One patient, she did do 40 visits of hyperbaric, and she runs 100 miles. She has a blog, TBI to 100. She did her second 100 miler and felt completely normal for 2 weeks, completely back to her original accident self. So explain that.
Wow. Then what happened?
Wait, she felt normal?
Normal
for 2 weeks and then regressed. You're saying?
After her second 100 run.
Well, a marathon is very aerobic, right?
That's
you're not going anaerobic enough.
So.
And so you're not pushing that anaerobic threshold ever in a marathon unless you're, you know, killing it. So if she's running a slow marathon, it's like a long walk. That's a great thing for a TBI patient, like
mm-hmm.
to some degree, as long as they don't go anaerobic.
Just have to figure out how to recreate that.
So, I mean, when you exercise, you upregulate your oxygen, you know, normally we're breathing 8 to 12 liters a minute. You might get 100 to 200 liters a minute, depending on how much you're exercising. So as long as some of that, a good bit more of that's going to her brain, maybe that helped her. At the same time, I wouldn't recommend it. It sounds like some older chick that, you know, that needed to prove herself.
She definitely did it for
coming around.
Yeah.
I have two questions. One is a follow-up question to that. Do you think that adrenaline release could have a effect on that two-week experience? I commonly... struggle with insomnia, and I'll be tempted to lean towards insomnia, knowing that it leads to a two-day, enhanced everything, pretty much.
Because you're getting a cortisol release by staying up late.
I feel very confident that's the source.
So, I mean, the good thing is, when you're not sleeping, you're probably inhaling a lot more. So, anybody ever slept at a hut, gone to a mountain?
Uh-huh.
Skiing out to a 12,000 foot hut, do you sleep well there?
No.
So when you have a brain injury, it's kind of like you're sleeping in high altitude.
Yeah.
You're not sleeping well because you're suffocating half the night. So part of what's happening when you stay up, you're upregulating those cortisol and that other thing. Go mountain climbing, I give you a shot of dexamethasone, you're going to be able to make it up to 20,000 feet and come back. Of course, you might crash eventually. It's going to be bad for your system. So yeah, you're getting that natural way of giving yourself a prednisone shot by not sleeping. And you're getting more oxygen. So yeah, you're gonna get a little more cortisone buzz, but you're gonna crash and probably not be as well if you keep doing that. The answer is more oxygen. I mean, even if you just breathe oxygen through a nasal cannula or oxygen concentrator, it'd be better than not sleeping, in my opinion. I mean, I can give you speed too, if you want. I mean, Adderall, and you might have the same effect, but.
It's for anyone that has anything to say about it, but I'm convinced that, at least for me, the major barrier for therapeutic things has been coverage and finance. So anything you could say about coverage or ways patients deal with meeting finance?
Do you guys want to talk?
That's a tough one because, like we kind of talked about, unfortunately, most of these treatments and different things aren't really covered, you know, by insurance and tend to be cash-based practices and stuff like that. And as I said, that's what's tough when patients have been everywhere because they've already spent all of this money and they're already running down, you know, low and stuff like that. So I feel like, I mean, the answer is pushing it to get it to mainstream where things are covered. But unfortunately right now it's a sticky situation.
We try to make it as affordable as we can. I mean, for a home hyperbaric chamber, you can rent that for $250 a month or lease it. So if you can afford something like that, in my opinion, that's one of the best therapies most patients can do. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a very effective, you can do insulin, cranial osteopathy, for example, is what a lot of what I do. That's covered by insurance. You know, we've got practitioners we work with that just take insurance for that. So it doesn't take, even if you don't have a lot of finances, you can still throw a few $100 a month at this and figure out what's the most important therapy. I know there's payment plans and neurofeedback, you get packages, deals. So, I mean, there's ways most practitioners like us work with patients that don't have as much finances. But it does take a little bit, and I think the expectation that insurance is going to cover it, it's not there yet. You know, we're doing sort of this pioneering work, and it's coming. And it has to have the studies behind it before the insurance companies, and the patients still demand it.
I have three neurotherapists that work at my clinic, and I scholarship one person per neurotherapist. So by scholarship, I'm talking $50 a session. So we try, you know. Sometimes people come in with scholarships they'll get somewhere else. Sometimes BIAC has some good
grant opportunities.
And certainly then if there's an accident of some kind and I can have a physician referral that's a medical component, then we have more success with the medical diagnosis submitting versus a mental health diagnosis submitting. That's the trick.
Question in the back?
Yeah, I have a question for Dr. Hughes. Just thinking about the physics of the hyperbaric, you know, we've got prooxidant, antioxidant, a lot of the effects for prevention of Alzheimer's and dementia involve antioxidants like curcumins and all this, and then we've got oxygen excess and free radicals and superoxide dismutase. So I'm going to have a look at your website for that research, but I'm just wondering, I mean, are there any downsides? This is like too much oxidation, you know, like running an ultra is actually prooxidant. Is there some?
It's a brilliant question, and it's one of the reasons with the protocols I do. Not only do we give hyperbaric oxygen, we're giving ketogenic, you know, diets, so that's protecting the brain from oxidative stress.
So
high fat diet, ketones, you know, versus it gives you more GAB in the brain, less glutamate, and if you think about like a very simple, you put oil in a pan and you heat it up, it's not going to oxidize as quickly. It's not going to boil it off as quickly. It's going to slowly heat up. It can handle the heat, right? It can handle the oxidative stress, the metabolic stress that you need to heal, because your brain's in a hypermetabolic crisis when you go through these states. There is so much oxidative stress anyway, and that's the challenge. I mean, and that's what happens if you go too high in the hyperbaric chamber, too much pressure. And that's like some people just throw everybody in at 2 atmospheres or more for brain injuries. It's like taking somebody who's been sitting on the bench, you know, been injured, and making them run a 400 at 50 seconds. You know, making them run a sprint pretty much. The key is not, they need exercise. We all need exercise. That's oxidative stress for all of us. With the right amount of antioxidants in our diet, and nutritive wise, along with the hyperbarics, we're gonna get success. But you can't go make somebody who's been sitting on the bench go run a sprint around the track. You gotta let them slowly work into it. You know, they're gonna run, you know, a minute and a half or more. They're gonna start jogging before they run. So over time, they will eventually be able to handle a little higher pressure. But generally, the biggest problem with hyperbaric clinics is they think more is better sometimes. And keeping them, and what we're finding is the research is showing that 1.1 to even 1.5 atmospheres, just barely over sea level, gives so much more benefit for a lot of the patients. And that's why the home chambers work. So, but, you know, not getting enough oxygen, it's going to be just as dangerous because you're not going to make energy. It's the oxidative redox, you know, aspects of life. We all get too much stress, it's not good. If you don't get enough stress, you're going to be a lazy bum and sit on the couch. It's that balance. Yeah. So
if you're just taking people down to sea level, couldn't there be some kind of environmental study done, brain injuries in Denver versus Los Angeles?
Patients do better in Maui versus Colorado in general.
So in general, people feel better at lower altitudes.
I mean, I think we all sleep better at sea level, right?
Well, but, you know, like when you have a normal system, I'm not saying brain injured, but, you know, your blood levels come up, you're relatively less anemic after about 3 months of living here, your body adjusts.
Sure.
But for people with brain injuries or, you know, I don't know, maybe even like MS and stuff like that, could you do some kind of comparative study in different altitudes to see?
I mean, that's what hyperbaric is, pretty much. It's throwing somebody at a different altitude for an hour.
Yeah.
And the nice thing is that patient gets an upregulation in their system for about 24 hours, 48 hours after they. So they get an upregulation of their metabolic processes. It helps them. Some people say even if you do a little exercise, you hypo-oxygenate before, you get an even better effect by getting in the hyperbaric chamber. So, it's a growing science. But the way it's done now is if you go too high with the hyperbarics, yeah, you're absolutely right. You'll over-oxidize the patient and cause too much oxidative stress.
Mm-hmm. Any last questions? We have about 1 minute.
I was wondering if you all have heard any of the research on lipoprotein A or lipoprotein little a and its plaquing effects. They say 1 out of every 5 stroke victims have excellent cholesterol, and most people don't find out that they have the genetic marker of lipoprotein A until they've had a stroke or a heart attack. The trainer on the World's Greatest Loser, that weight loss show, Bob Harper, excellent shape. He had a heart attack a few months back, and he has the lipoprotein A genetic marker. They think over 60 million Americans have it, and it's not a part of our lipid panel testing currently.
So I feel like with genetic testing, there can be a lot of really good benefits, right? There's all sorts of MTHFR or lipoprotein E4, all these different things, you know, that can set up for genetic predisposition. But I also feel like some of that genetic testing, right, you always have, you know, the genotype and the phenotype. So the question is, if someone has it, are they truly expressing the gene, right? If we look at, you know, genetics these days, right, everything we do, you know, ketogenic diet, perfect example, turning on and off genes and everything we do in our environment manipulates it. So I agree. I think there's a lot better indicators with cardiovascular risk and other testing that should be run, especially when it comes to heart disease. It's so much more than just total cholesterol, and you know that's what people live it at. They, you know, is there inflammation? What is the particle size? What else is going on to cause oxidation to lay down plaque? So I think it's, you know, it can tell you a lot, but I see a lot of also genetic testing can tend to put a lot of fear in people, and the question is, will that manifest, will it not? Okay, well maybe we should take a preemptive strategy and focus more down this route since you are showing to have that, you know, whatever it may be. So I think it can be good from that realm, I don't know.
And sort of need more research.
Yeah, I agree. Yes.
We've been looking at ApoE for some of our study markers before we do that, because like Alzheimer patients or TBI patients may not improve as well with that therapy based on some of those markers. So I definitely think it's great to bring that up.
We are out of time.